Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a decorated World War II Navy pilot remembers the day war came to the California coast.
A Japanese submarine came to Santa Barbara, supposedly had a catapult airplane on, and was coming over to bomb Los Angeles. Every radio in the city of L.A. said, turn off your lights.
The surprising way that night changed his life forever. And more stories from this veteran's new book, today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our Hometown Heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And not only are we educated, I believe we're inspired along the way by how much these people love our country. I'm certain that's going to be the case today with 92-year-old Irvin Cooper of Los Angeles, California. He is the author of a new book called Peter Bogey Mike, and we'll get to the significance of that title. But Mr. Cooper, I've got to ask you, first of all, you know, I meet a lot of people that are in their 80s and 90s, and you don't look 92. What's your secret? How do you get around so well and stay so young and active?
I don't know if I blame it on the Levi, but I think it's in the genes. And that, and having a wonderful wife that served balanced meals and stuff like that. She asked me to say that, so I'm putting that in, but it's true.
Well, after 69 years, I think she has a say, doesn't she?
She does, she does.
You guys are headed for your 70th anniversary in March, and we're going to talk about how you met. We're going to hear also about your adventures in the PBM Martin Mariner during World War II. But let's go back before that. I know you're born in New York. You moved out to California at a very young age. What was it like growing up in California in the 20s and 30s? What are the kind of things that you remember?
I was very fortunate to grow up with Japanese, Chinese, Black, Mexican, White Russians, Jewish, every denomination in Boyle Heights of Los Angeles, which was a very involved mixed ethnic group. I think from that I really developed a respect for other groups, and I've maintained that my whole life, and I have friends in all the categories, and I don't look at them as that. I look at them as individuals. And to me, there's only two kinds of people, good people and bad people, and this is the creed that I've followed my whole life.
Well, clearly it served you well. I know we've got a lot of stories we'll try to fit into this hour, and there are a few things I know I want to ask you about. But as a teenager, as a young man, we all have ambitions and dreams. What were some of the dreams you remember, and was flying one of them at even an early age?
I don't think flying was about the furthest thing from my mind. I don't know where a poor Jewish kid in East L.A. is thinking about flying, but I wanted to be an artist, and I wanted to be in journalism, and Walter Winchell was my idol at the time and stuff like that. I guess that was my outlook for an outside professional life, and I enjoyed athletics. Even though I was small, but I participated in everything. I was an only child, and I was much on my own, and fortunately fared very, very well.
What high school did you go to?
I went to Dorsey High School in Los Angeles when they opened it in 1938. I went to L.A. High, and then they opened Dorsey High in 38, and it was supposed to be the most modern, progressive school. It was so progressive that they let me go through school without taking language, without taking math, without taking a lot of the stuff. So I was great in wood shop, printing, journalism, and athletics, and everything else. And when I graduated, I did not have anything to be able to go on to college. So in spite of the great reputation that Dorsey has, it really didn't do me very well.
So what did you do when you got out of high school?
Well, I realized that I didn't have anything, so I went on to junior college. I went on to L.A. City College. I graduated in 39. And I went to work for Lockheed Aircraft Company at 50 cents an hour, which was great.
This was up in Burbank, building P-38s?
I riveted P-38s, saved up enough money. After I acquired $900 out of a brand new Chevy Club Coupe, red, and all paid for in cash, and that was my pride.
Were you working at the Lockheed plant when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor? What do you remember about December 7th?
I was working at Lockheed, and the next morning I went to school at L.A. Junior College. I was in a print class called with Mr. Green, who was the head of the printing class, and we had a basketball team called the Green Printers. And we were playing a Japanese basketball team that day. And we went out, and neither of us knew how to behave. We played an absolute, total, silent basketball game. Nobody said anything, just played the game. We didn't know how to react to each other, because basically we're casual friends. That was December 8th.
Wow, you know, and I ask every single veteran about that, because everyone remembers something, but I haven't heard that one, that they had to play a basketball game against Japanese players. And you mentioned growing up in a neighborhood where there were so many different cultures. So I imagine you had a lot of Japanese-American friends.
I did, yes.
How did what ensued after December 7th and Executive Order 9066 and the internment camps and all that, how did you see that playing out from your perspective?
Well, we reacted to what was told. We were told the Japanese people were going to do things to the United States and stuff like that, and so they were... It interned them. We were not sophisticated enough to realize that they were really basically American citizens. And they were, if anyone was upset, they were the ones, because their ethnic background was attacking the country in which they lived. But they were sent to Manzanar, the ones that I knew. When I joined the Navy, I was sent to Lone Pine, California for preliminary flight training. The Navy couldn't take in enough cadets to fly. They didn't have the facilities, so they sent us to a private flying school while we were waiting around. And we went to Lone Pine, California, and I used to fly over Manzanar, you know, really very odd situation.
So you would look down and see with your own eyes the conditions that your old friends were living in.
Yeah, and it was, you know, startling, and I didn't know if they were attackers of the country or not. You know, what would I know?
And speaking of, a lot of people don't realize, everyone knows that Pearl Harbor happened, but people don't know that there were other incidents on the west coast of the mainland that happened in late 1941 and early 1942. And you know, because it's a pretty important night in your life, and it's how you met your wife, thanks to the Japanese. Without the Japanese showing up on the Pacific coast of California, you never would have met your wife. Am I getting that straight?
Am I grateful to the Japanese or not? I don't know. No, it happened, I think it was February 4th or 5th of 1942. A Japanese submarine came to Santa Barbara and supposedly had a catapult airplane on. It was coming over to bomb Los Angeles. So every radio in the city of L.A. said, turn off your lights, close all the shade, do everything you want. On Baldwin Hills, which is not too far from where I live, near Dorsey High School, they had Hollywood Klieg lights up on top of the hills, and they were scouring the sky looking for the aircraft to come in. So I got out of my house to go to work, and I used to leave early for work, around 10 o'clock or so, and I'd go to the Hollywood Palladium or any of the nightclubs up there, and I'd stand and watch the jazz band, Benny Goodman, Tommy Dorsey, Jimmy Dorsey, all of them play, and then go on to work at Lockheed at 12 o'clock. And then get off at 7:30 in the morning and go to L.A. City College. Well, on that particular date, I left at around 10, and I pulled out. I got out, and I looked up, and the sky was completely black with stars. You know, you never see that in a city. All the lights were out. So you could be in Big Bear or Arrowhead, and it was very beautiful. I backed my beautiful $900 brand-new Chevy out. And two doors away, I see this young girl standing looking at the stars also. So I pulled over and I said, gee, well, how pretty it is. And we had a discussion, and that's how I met my Elaine. We started to talk and get more comfortable. I carried a convenient blanket in the back seat of the car, and I put it on the lawn. And I believe her brother was out looking from the window, make sure she was covered. But we sat on the lawn and talked, and that's how I started, and that's how we met.
But without the blackout, you never would have been out there.
No, I'd have probably just gone right on by as I usually did.
Well, somebody must have had a plan for you, too, because 69 years later, almost 70, you're still going strong. Working in a defense industry at the Lockheed plant, I'm sure you were exempt from actually going into the military. How did it occur that you became a Navy pilot?
Well, I was so anti-war, and on San Vicente Boulevard here in Los Angeles, there were 400 wheelchairs that circled San Vicente to Wilshire Boulevard. And these were all veterans that sat there with mustard gas poisoning from World War I. And I decided that war was not for me. I was going to get a job and I'll work and I'll build stuff like that. However, when Pearl Harbor happened, it changed my whole attitude. Our country was attacked and my pacifistic views turned and I wanted to do my part. The problem is, how would I want to do it? I didn't want to become a soldier and slog around in that. I felt smarter than that. And the only way, after having met Elaine, also at that time, her brothers, one was going to be a doctor in the Army, and the other was going to be an engineer in the Navy, and they would both be commissioned officers. I could not go in the Navy as a sailor and compete with this young lady's brothers. So the only way I could do it was to fly. The Army would take you in with a high school diploma. And my best friend, a fellow named Jerry Foreman, signed on right away. And he was going to be a doctor. And he was the top quarterback on the football team and the catcher on the baseball team, very athletic. And 9 months later, he was shot down in a P-38 over England. That's just a side story. I'm only telling you that because I really wanted to go in the Navy. The Army put you out in war in 9 months. The Navy had 18 months of training before you got in. So, and I always liked the ocean and Venice and the whole thing like that. But the Army was getting all the cadets, all the people recruited. The Navy, there were only so many graduates of college, so they lowered the restrictions, said if you had 2 years of college and could pass this test, they would take you. So when that opened up, my best friend and I went down, took the test, passed, and joined the Naval Air Corps.
I've got to ask you also, just, you know, in retrospect, we know what was going on in the world and what was happening in the different theaters. And I know you talked about Walter Winchell, and I'm sure you heard Edward R. Murrow on the radio and you read the newspapers. But as someone of Jewish heritage, were you at all aware of what was going on in Europe and how the Jewish people were being persecuted there?
I don't think we realized that at all. But I personally didn't realize what was going on. And it was such a distant thing. And at 18, 19 years of age, you don't really concentrate on that sort of thing unless it's brought forward for you to know.
So you get into to naval aviation. And where was your relationship with Elaine at this point? Were you thinking, you know, this is the girl I'm going to marry if I get back from this war? Or what was in your mind?
I tried to date her a couple of times. And finally, she went to the movies with me a few times. We sort of clicked along. It was kind of embarrassing because the Navy hadn't taken us in, and we'd walk around in civilian clothes, and people would say, how come healthy young men like you aren't in the service, you know? So the Navy took us and said, we're going to put you into a private flying school temporarily. When you part from somebody that you like, you start writing letters. And so we write letters back and forth, even though we were only a few hundred miles away. But I went through pre-flight training, and I got my little silver civilian pilot training wings, and I came back somewhat heroic because I was now competing with her brothers, and yeah, we started a date. And I think it was about the fourth or fifth date or something like that, but we got along very well. And it was my birthday on the following year that I proposed.
Before you went overseas, you proposed?
Before I even finished training. I came back, and we stood around again. Then they sent us to another private, an advanced private school, which was in Susanville, California. So I've never been in the snow in my life, but up there that did snow. They took skis and put them on the wheels of the airplane, and so I've skied the airplane off and learned to fly with that. Before I went in the Navy, I had about 100 hours of civilian pilot training. The whole purpose was between the writing and to coming and meet Elaine each time I was there. We became very, very close.
Well, that gave you something to come back home for once you actually had to go overseas. And I want to talk about the planes that you flew, because the title of your book indicates the plane you spent the most time in, but that wasn't the first plane you were flying. And how primitive were seaplanes in the 1940s?
Well, the seaplanes, I think they were rather sophisticated compared to the other aircraft. Coming back from the private flying school, when they finally accepted us into the Navy, they sent us to a pre-flight school, which was very difficult. And as I started to tell you earlier, my scholastic background was rather weak. And I went into a pre-flight school at Del Monte Pre-Flight School up in Monterey. And I met all these college-educated people, and I'm supposed to be with 2 years of junior college. And we took our first math class. The officer that came out, he came on the board, and he put one, and drew a line under knife and said, that means equals two. He says, this is the way we're starting. Well, the guys that had been through college were really bored silly. But in 1 day or 2 days, we went through elementary math. The next day, they went into high school math, and I went crazy trying to keep up with them. So it was very difficult for me, and I was very fortunate to be able to complete the course. At that point, Elaine came up to visit me in Monterey, and when they came up in an entourage. My mother came up, all the mothers of all the group that we knew came up there, and my mother brought her diamond ring that she had given me to give to Elaine, which I have in the book because it had a slight chip in it. I proposed to Elaine and she accepted. Elaine was a little bit disturbed because my mother had said, if the wedding doesn't go through, will you give the ring back?
I guess almost 70 years later we can say it went through, huh?
And the chip is still there.
And what kind of thrills did you have in those early seaplane flights that you got to experience?
The biggest thrill I had is when my best friend and I, his name was Bud Plone, when we were sworn into the Navy to show how brave we were, we drove down Wilshire Boulevard to Santa Monica Pier and went on the roller coaster. And we sat in the front seat, and it was the most harrowing experience I have had in my whole life. I just wanted to show how brave we were, and I was really skeptical when we got off. And I realized the difference between a roller coaster and an airplane. In an airplane, you have control. In the roller coaster, you're just sitting there going wherever it turns. So after pre-flight school, we went to primary training. And that's in a Stearman, an open cockpit airplane, bi-wing. And that airplane was made by Boeing and took the most abuse any plane could ever take.
Did it ever occur to you that what you were doing might have a little danger involved in it, or that you were taking your life into your own hands, or were you just carefree and hard charging?
I don't believe I was ever carefree, and I think I was always conscious of the airplane and what it is. Of all the things, I used to do handstands and acrobatic stuff, but I could not stand acrobatics in the air. When they turned me upside down, I was completely helpless. On the other hand, on the specific stuff like landings and takes off and pylons and stuff that had to be absolutely strict, I was really terrific. So when I went through training, they would scratch their head because I did the worst acrobatics they would have, but I was about as smooth. They would cut the engine and I'd hit a circle dead center every time, and I fortunately got through. Fortunately, I never had to do acrobatics afterwards. I'd have probably never been a fighter pilot, actually. And I ended up at Corpus Christi, and they assigned me to the OS-2U, which is a Kingfisher, a single-engine seaplane. The training there was you would go out on a cruiser or battleship and they would catapult you off and you would fly 100 miles out to see if there was, we didn't have the radar at the time, to see if there was anything dangerous and you would report back.
Did you ever get to do that, to get catapulted off one of those ships?
One of the big thrills I had was when I soloed an airplane at Lone Pine and when I was catapulted off of a catapult and all that. And I must admit at that time, I think of myself as a little kid from Boyle Heights sitting in a Navy aircraft being shot off, and I said, my God, I would compare myself to Tyrone Power, to Clark Gable, to John Wayne. As I went along, I realized I suddenly was John Wayne, so it was very simple.
Well, and you sure look like a Hollywood movie star in some of these photos in your book. Peter Bogey Mike is the title. 92-year-old Irvin Cooper is the author, and we'll dive deeper into his story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 92-year-old Irvin Cooper of Los Angeles, the author of a new book called Peter Bogey Mike, A Love Story, A War Story. Grab a pen and paper because before long I'm going to tell you how you can get it. The cover features photos of Irv and his wife of nearly 70 years, Elaine. The photo of Irv there is the one he calls the $5,000 picture. And there's a great story behind that. You'll have to read his book to find out. Another thing you'll find in the book is his citation signed by the Secretary of the Navy when Irv was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. That prestigious medal hangs in his home office. But let's explain the title now. Peter Bogey Mike. That's the call sign of the aircraft you spent so many hours in?
Peter Bogey Mike stands for Patrol Bomber Martin. That was the largest twin-engine seaplane that the Navy had. It was very sophisticated, had radar, could actually fly 20 hours in the air at a time, and most of the flights ran from 12 to 16 hours in actual combat zones. I got to that because in training for the catapult aircraft, on my last flight, I had an oil cap blow off, and I had to land my aircraft in an emergency. That was the day before we graduated, or a couple days before. When I went to graduate, they held my orders because I was short an hour's night flight, because I hadn't completed the full time. And I was very disappointed because they didn't have enough cruisers and battleships to accommodate catapult airplanes, so they sent us to become flight instructors.
Well, if you were a flight instructor, then you'd be back here in the States and you could see plenty of Elaine.
That was my big thrill at the time. As much as I was eager, this was even more exciting for me. My whole class graduated without me, and I said, but they will. And he said, they'll go ahead without you. Don't worry, you know. And they did. And I waited around 3 days while they had a storm in Corpus Christi, and I finally took an airplane and flew around for a couple hours at night, and I qualified for my wings, and I graduated with the next graduating class. But those orders were all sent to multi-engine flight school for seaplanes. And I said, but I've never been in a multi-engine seaplane. He said, well, you're a naval aviator. You can do it. And I could, so it's not that big a deal.
Just out of curiosity, what happened to all those guys that you would have left with, had the paperwork?
They all became instructors. There's only one of them really that I kept in touch with, a fellow named Al Madler, who was dying to become a fighter pilot, and he was a great pilot. He ended up as an instructor, and my best friend, Bud Plone, also ended up as an instructor.
So you wouldn't have been writing a book about PBMs, because you never would have touched one, huh?
That's it. I would have been just another instructor.
So how did it work out? You had no experience in these multi-engine seaplanes, but I guess you had to pick some experience up in a hurry.
Yeah, when I got into the multi-engine airplane, to step down and look up 10 feet up off the ground or the water to look up and see where the pilot sat was really pretty exciting. And since I had all the experience in a seaplane, working twin engines was very enjoyable because one engine would turn and the other engine would reverse it, and I learned to control it, and I kept up with my class. No one ever knew that I never flew a PBY, so I went through training very, very well.
All the other guys, I assume, probably had that experience, because this was kind of the upgrade on the PBY.
Yeah, they all flew the PBYs.
What is it that you appreciate about the PBM? Because you spent a lot of time in it, not just a lot of missions, but those are long missions, so that's a lot of hours that you spent in that aircraft. What did you come to love about it?
Well, it's reliability, number one. I loved its radar, so what we could do. We attacked a Japanese convoy, which was very unusual. The convoy was 1,000 miles from Okinawa and up the Yellow Sea, where the Japanese had a group of ships going across, and they thought we could surprise them. They told us that what a great surprise. Nobody would expect to be attacked at that distance. Since they had no carrier planes that could go that far and back, they said PBMs will make history that night.
Because you guys had significant range. You could fly a long way.
We could fly several thousand miles. So we flew up, and we flew like 100 feet off the water in the dead of the night for 1,000 miles.
What is that like? I mean,
that's a wrestling match, because we couldn't use automatic pilot, and you had to be very... The three pilots on the plane, we alternated flying, because it was kind of strenuous. When we got within 100 miles of the Japanese task force, we dropped down to 50 feet and flew low, and we had torpedoes under us, and we attacked this group. Before that, we had asked what the odds were on doing it, and they said, well, the whole operation is based on surprise, and we expect all of you to get through. Then there was a pause and said, at the worst, possibly three won't make it. Well, they send three planes from our squadron, VPB-27. They send three planes from another squadron, 208, and our three looked at their three to see which one of us is going to get through.
So you had six planes, and they said at worst, three won't make it.
That's at the worst. You ask about fear, stuff like that. You do your duty. You really don't think of the fear. You think of the job you're doing. And, of course, the crews were crazy. We came out and told them we're going to attack this Japanese fleet. Oh, they're jumping up like they're going to a high school football game, and I'm looking at them, you idiot, you may not come back from this thing. You know, the adrenaline, because the boredom of flying for hours and hours with binoculars and stuff and looking is really a very tiresome deal. But fortunately, we all got through. And you asked me about the plane. I have a hole in my wing that you could crawl through. There's a picture of it in the book, too. And all the planes were riddled with bullets. A lot of the members were shot, but nobody got killed or anything like that. And it was a really tough, tough aircraft, so I had to love it.
Well, yeah, I guess so. And just so people understand, you talked about the crew. How many men would you have on the crew of a PBM?
PBM carried a crew of 12. There were three pilots, and usually they flew 8 hours and navigated four. We'd alternate in that. We had one plane commander and two co-pilots, and we all became plane commanders when our tour of duty was over. So I was looking forward to having my own crew, but fortunately the war ended and I didn't have that opportunity. We had 12 men, three pilots and nine crew members. And when we were in the war zone at Saipan and Okinawa, the Japanese were known to swim out from the islands individually, climb into an airplane and blow it up as best they could. So we had a deal that we lived aboard a seaplane tender, but every third night, one pilot and three crew members would have to stay aboard the ship, and one guy would be sitting up on the wing with a gun, supposedly, you know, looking out for anybody to climb on the plane. So it was kind of rough duty in that respect. The other prospect that disturbed me most, we were at a place called Buckner Bay after Okinawa was pretty well secured, and realized our tender was about 25, 30 miles away from American soldiers that were buried into the hills in mud, mosquitoes, heat, eating packaged food out there. And I would get up in the morning and go into my wardroom of the plane, take my napkin ring with my own napkin out, and sit down and have be served and stuff like that. And the comparison to me was really, really bothered the hell out of me. And I had such great respect for those guys and how many thousands of them got killed there. The only aspect that we really saw is in our time, I must have seen anywhere between, I'd say, 50 to 100 or more kamikaze aircraft. And being on the size ship, our ship was the size of a destroyer, and we would be parked in the harbors with larger ships. So when the kamikazes come in, they would roll over and go for the larger ship. Unfortunately, at the beginning of that, as the kamikazes would come down, the gunners on all the ships would have their guns aimed at the kamikazes up at the sky, and they would follow with the guns right on down until they came to the water. Because of their adrenaline and excitement, they inadvertently kept on firing when it was horizontally, and they'd be shooting at the ships that parallel to them. And we had people hit on our ship and brought in that was shot by the ship across the way.
And what was that ship, the seaplane tender?
The Shelikov was our ship. Our squadron had three ships that were divided, had six craft on each ship with buoys tied to them that the planes were.
And you mentioned Buckner Bay. I know that's also, I saw a picture on your wall of you having the Distinguished Flying Cross pinned on you, and that's where you received that. And that mission that you talk about of attacking the convoy, and you said the element of surprise was going to be big. And I mean, I haven't been there, so this is just my little humble brain trying to figure this out. But a convoy indicates a pretty large amount of ships. And you might sneak up on the first one, but I imagine the one at the end of the line probably has a little more lead time on you coming. Did you guys get shot up on that mission?
Yes, so they gave us the assignment. 208 Squadron, the VP-27 Squadron, flipped a coin, and 208 was going to go in first, and we'd be 5 minutes later. So we were following 5 minutes later, and we got to the convoy. Well, the sky opened up, and I have written it looked like the Coliseum on the 4th of July, and I can't believe. Sanity would say you turn your plane around and not do it, but because of your youth and training and your mission, you just keep on barreling on in, and you take whatever the subsequences are, and you just do it. So we all got through, all shot up.
And what does that feel like when you're going through? And this is low level. It's not like you're way up there. You're pretty close to
maybe just 100 feet off the water.
So when your plane gets hit, you feel it?
When our plane got hit, well, we had... I thought it was fireflies flying, but it was all bullets that were hitting us. And when we got hit by the wing of our aircraft by some kind of cannon fire that made a hole that large, the plane, you know, popped up in the air. And I was the only, you just accept it and you react immediately. We immediately choked our engines and filled it with fire retardant material into the engine. And you do everything you're trained to do, and you come out of it. All of a sudden, you realize you were through, and you just passed.
Am I understanding it right that if you have that big hole in your airplane, whatever hit you, you were so low to the ground that it went through your wing, but it didn't explode because it didn't have time to arm itself or the
right.
Setting on it?
True. I never even thought of it that way, other than the fact that we have the hole there. And it hit the ailerons of the plane, so we had to wrestle it. It's like, I think we described it like having a car without power steering, so we had to fight that thing for about 900 miles all the way back. On top of that, I didn't know if the wing would hold up. If the, had the shot been 10 feet closer, it would have been right in the middle of our cabin, and only five of the six planes would have returned.
That sounds close enough to me. And you wouldn't have had these 69 years with Elaine, and you wouldn't be able to talk about children and grandchildren.
Let me think of the options on that, which was the best deal.
You better not think too hard. When you think about that, and you've written about it in this book, of how close you were to it all ending right there, do you feel like somebody was looking out for you? Something was protecting you? Was it just chance and luck? How do you account for it?
It's very interesting, because a lot of my guys start crossing themselves back and forth. And I said, well, my savior is Elaine. I felt she brought me through rather than a god or symbol or anything else. And I felt that all through the war.
Did you carry a picture of her with you?
I carried a picture of her my whole time in my chest pocket. It's also in the book, too.
And in that particular instance, when you're trying to wrestle this plane and get this 12-man crew back to safety, a long way to go, was there a point in there where you thought you weren't going to make it, where this was it? Were you preparing yourself?
It's interesting that you say that, because you're not afraid of it, but you logically think of what could happen. You think, that thing goes down, we're going down. And you looked at it that way. One of the interesting things, in this airplane had a double deck, and the pilot sat up in the upper deck, and the engineer was down below, and I ran down. His name was Smokey Stover, and I looked at him. He's sitting there covered with blood, and I said, oh, my God. Are you okay? And he said, I'm okay. A hydraulic line had been hit. And the hot red hydraulic, he was sitting there saturated in oil, but he wasn't hurt. So that was good.
Well, Hollywood could take some notes. If they ever need fake blood, try some of those hydraulic lines from a PBM. And that mission is an extreme circumstance. But I imagine your typical mission was a lot more mundane than that. You're probably just scanning those endless miles of ocean looking for submarines?
We looked for submarines, but we also shot up trawlers. And one of the interesting things, we'd have depth charge bombs on our plane, and we'd go across the China coast, and we were instructed that any ship that we saw, or any boat or flotilla of any kind, if it had a motor, it was Japanese, you sink it. If it was just with a sail, you leave it alone, it was probably the Chinese. So we would leave the coast of China, and maybe about 5 or 6 miles off the coast, there would be 50 sampans all fishing for fish. So we had to get rid of our bombs. We couldn't land in the water, because sometimes the water would be so hard the bomb could blow up in the planes. We had to just get rid of them. So we would dive over the Chinese sampans, and they would lean over from the engine blast in the back, and we'd pull out a few miles away and drop our bombs. And the minute we did that, they learned, because they did this almost every time they flew, all the sampans ran, because the concussion in the water brought all the fish up, so they could come up and knit them all and get them all in the net. So that was a plus.
Well, some fishermen out there might get some ideas. If you know a guy with a PBM and some bombs, good luck. That's quite a picture we all have in our imaginations now, isn't it? It's time for another break. But when we come back, more stories from Irvin Cooper's book, Peter Bogey Mike. I'll also tell you how you can get it, so get that pen and paper handy. Hometown Heroes will bring this PBM pilot in for a landing right after this.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Irvin Cooper of Los Angeles. He was a naval aviator in World War II and insists he's 92 years old, but he sure doesn't look like it. If you look through the pages of his new book, Peter Bogey Mike, you'll find quite a few photos that'll grab your attention, like the one of the cannon hole in the wing of their PBM. You'll find some of the stories that we've heard on the show today, and some we haven't. Pretty entertaining stuff with regard to his wedding to Elaine. They're going to celebrate their 70th anniversary this March. And I think you'll also get a kick out of how he managed to get into USC after the war. That's a good story. Soon you'll be able to find the book on Amazon, but for now, the only way to get Peter Bogey Mike is to write to the P.O. box I'm about to give you. I do have this posted on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page as well. The paperback is $14.95. There's also a hardcover edition, and here's that address. Peter Bogey Mike, P.O. Box 3467. That's box 34673, Los Angeles, California. The zip is 90034. You can email me also for more information, paul@hometownheroesradio.com.
That's Paul at hometownheroesradio.com. Anyway, back to Mr. Cooper now. I mentioned a few things folks can find in your book. Any more stories in there that you'd really like to share now?
Well, probably the most significant one is that if you put about 200 hours on your airplane, when we were at the Okinawa phase, they would send the plane back to Saipan. They'd take the engines out and redo the engine. It took 5 days. So we always had a plane at Saipan being redone, and we would have 5 days of R&R. They had a listed men's club, they had an officer's club, drinking and everything that you'd want to do, and they had beautiful Quonset huts and coral walkways and things like that. They had tennis courts. I saw Bobby Riggs work out there with a group that came over to entertain the troops. So we had a great time, beautiful beaches with cleared, and this was our time for our 5 days. And we landed there, and when they pulled the plane up off the ramp, I see one of our planes still sitting there. And I quit, what are you doing here? And one of the pilots, named James Bistadeau, the co-pilot, they gave you a physical, and then you were free for the time. He couldn't pass an eye test. So they measured him for glasses, and they took a Navy plane, flew to Midway, and they made up glasses for him. And he was supposed to get it back in time so he'd go back with his crew. So when we all got out, the three pilots and our crew are standing there, and they said, one of you will have to go back with this crew. And Joe Igles was our plane commander, and Amos Crum and I were the two co-pilots. So Amos and I have to flip. So we flip a coin, and I watch it circle around until George Washington's land flat, and his eyes look up at Amos, and he'd called heads. So I had to go back. So I went back with another crew, Otho Edwards was his name, a friend named Bill Holligan. We were both aboard the same ship, so we were very friendly. So I had to give up my flight time. And I went back with them. And as soon as we took off, Otho, who was the plane captain, said, I want you to run the thing. So he wanted to see how skilled I was and how he'd fit in. And after a couple hours, he said, that's great. And we took over from there. So I was accepted. When I got back to our ship, we went out on about two or three missions every other night. And on the fourth night, our crew still hadn't returned. And we're standing on the deck. We have to go down a ladder, get on a launch, and go to our airplane and take off. So we're waiting for the launch to take us off on a night flight. And I'm standing there in my flight suit, and Elaine's picture in my chest, as well as some fishing gear down in my pockets, and a knife and a 38 pistol on my hip, and all that sort of stuff ready to go. And the launch pulls up, and we're waiting for the crew to come up, and it turns out to be my crew. Hey, and they look great. They're all suntanned and everything else. And they're kidding me, how have you been? And as they climb up, James Bistadeau comes up with his glasses on. And I said to him, hey, James, I think, Jim, you better go with your crew tonight. I don't want to go out with your crew. He says, yeah, but I flew all day and you want me to fly tonight? I said, if I fly with your crew tonight, then I have to fly with my crew tomorrow. And normally I'm really easy on stuff. I don't care. I've never been picky. But I insisted on the thing. I said, I had to fly two times going. You took my R&R, the whole thing. And he knew that. He said, ah, hell. So he threw his duffel bag at me, put it on my bunk. So they climbed down, and all the crew that I was supposed to go with went down. My crew was up. We're all hugging, shaking hands. And as Otho Edwards is the last one down, he puts his thumb up and says, I'll see you when you get back. Okay. We never see them again. And the following morning, we were supposed to go out on a flight, and they came in and tell us, we're changing your flight, that Otho Edwards and another plane from our squadron, a new arrival, had been lost, and we spent the time looking for them. So I came within a minute of being on that flight, and I think that's probably the closest time I really came to not coming back at all. And it isn't until I started to write the book and realize that those guys had been at the bottom of the water off Formosa, which is now Taiwan, for the last 50 years, and have not had the life I've had, the family, schooling, the education and everything that I've enjoyed. It's been some kind of a little bit tough to think about. It just the way it goes.
Did you ever find out what had happened? Were they shot down? Was it weather or nobody knows?
The report was they had shot up three trawlers and beached them and shot them up, and then they went looking for it. They think they may have found a submarine. And we had practiced a tactic in Hilo, Hawaii, where there was a submarine and two aircraft. They usually come up and try to shoot at you with a cannon. So one plane would come from one side and one would come from the other. and we would crisscross over the plane. Well, Otho Edwards, the crew that I would have been with, had been on that practice. The other crew was a brand new replacement crew and probably hadn't had the same thing. And my feeling is that they probably hit each other. And it wasn't until almost 2 weeks later they finally found one float. But if two planes hit carrying 500-pound depth charges and they hit and they blow up, I mean, everything is totally obliterated. So it's a little scary.
So that awareness that you have, and I understand that the complex emotions that this brings up for you, and especially writing about it in a book to share it with everyone else. But is that something now that, because you realize that could have been you, that it could have all ended right there, that the life you do have is something that you really can't take for granted?
I've never taken. I really cherished my time and been very fortunate with a wonderful family and great friends and activities. I've worked doing what I've enjoyed doing, which was fun. I was a teacher and I was a builder and an architect, and I've done all of that. It's been great, great pleasure. Unfortunately, I didn't make a lot of money, but I made a lot of friends, so what?
Including one really important one who's still by your side all these years later. I've heard that you might have a few Hollywood stories too, some names we might recognize that you've crossed paths with.
The Hollywood thing is a terrible myth, but you got to realize that when the war broke out, the Army had an Army pre-flight school in Santa Ana, and they had thousands of cadets come here. And there's nothing in Santa Ana at the time, but how far were they from Hollywood? My God. So this city was just mobbed with people coming in from outskirts to see Hollywood. They set up the Hollywood Canteen. They closed off Hollywood Boulevard. They had dancing in the street. They had donuts and actresses coming and doing all sorts of things like that, because this was the wild-eyed thing. So when I go in the Navy and I'm sitting in the pre-flight school and they know I'm from Los Angeles, they said, "You're from Hollywood?" And I said, "Yes." So I immediately became a celebrity just by being from Hollywood, because all these guys are from the Midwest and everything else. "Did you know Henry Fonda?" Well, I didn't know him very well. I'd been to parties with him, and I saw him. He's a very nice guy. Well, the minute I told that to that guy, he became a celebrity, because he went home and wrote to his parents and his girlfriend, "I met this guy," and all. I carried that all the way through the service.
I know there's something else that I should probably cover with you. You got to come home and see Elaine again and have your family, because the war did end and the atomic bomb was a big part of that. When they dropped the second bomb on Nagasaki, you had a pretty unique perspective on what happened there. Tell me about that.
The war was winding down and we heard about the atomic bomb. Strangely enough, the Japanese military would not give up. They were determined, and they had every man, woman, and child in Japan told them, when the Americans invade, whatever you do, you try to kill somebody. Little kids with sticks, stones, guns, whatever they could have. I was at a place called Ulithi, and I saw 5,000, I'm using the word 5,000 because I don't know how to describe it anymore, of ships of every kind, from battleships, cruisers, to tankers, to ships holding supplies, water, men, and all that ready to invade, a million men ready to invade Japan. And they were just standing by. And the atomic bomb went off, and the Japanese said, "No, we're not going to do it again." So they did the second atomic bomb, which was at Nagasaki. And I understand the Japanese generals and all still refused. It was Hirohito himself who stepped in and said that enough is enough. But had they invaded, they would have lost, I don't know how many men they would have lost, but they would have lost millions of Japanese people too at the same time. Anyway, the bomb went off and we heard about it. And we were on a patrol, just a general patrol, whatever things were left over and stuff. And we were flying along. They gave us an assignment to go to, and I don't remember the name, prisoner of war camp, where a group of Australians were all in captive. And when I went to the plane, instead of having bombs on it, we were loaded with chocolate, with supplies for toothbrushes, teeth, oh, everything you can imagine, care packages galore, and little parachutes. And when you get over there, I want you to drop this stuff over there. So that was our mission. As we were going along, I think I was flying, and Amos was the navigator at the time. He says, "Hey, we're only about a half hour from Nagasaki. So we were free, and we flew over and got to Nagasaki. There was two valleys there. Japan is so green and beautiful from the sky. I remember flying along the coast and saying, I got to bring Elaine back to see this. This is unbelievable. The agriculture from the top of a little mountain down to the bottom was all just immaculately done. And we go over this beautiful valley, and the other side was completely browned out, like you could see streets in there and nothing. It was a concrete building that was sagging in the middle of it. And we flew around that thing. And sitting in the plane, I was holding, as we did, we were holding our crotch, if you'll excuse us, because we heard of this word we'd never heard of before. Irradiation. What kind of word is that? Never heard of a thing like irradiation. What kind of word is that? Never heard of a thing like, well, it's the radiation will come. If it hits you, you won't have kids. You won't have anything. So here we are flying with our hand over our crotch, our hand on the wheel, and we're tipping around flying. We better get the hell out of here. So, and we took some pictures of it there, and we left Nagasaki. We flew over the Japanese camp. Apparently, the people that ran the camp, the Japanese soldiers or whatever, they just took off and left the prisoners there. And we dropped our supplies, and I have a picture of the prisoners coming out, taking off their shirts or whatever they had, and they wrote thanks on the ground that you can see. So that was quite an event.
I could see how that would stick in your mind. And I imagine the other thing that stuck in your mind was the war ending and you getting to come home and actually seeing Elaine again. Do you remember what that felt like, what that moment was like?
Every day I was looking forward to seeing Elaine again. And the interesting part about that is we took our planes back. We had a chance to go on into Japan to a Japanese seaplane base there or come home. Had I not been married, I'd have gone into Japan, as most of the younger guys, not most of the single guys did, but the married guys said we'd rather go home. So we took a plane back, and we landed back in Kaneohe Bay in Hawaii, and there was a carrier coming that loaded up people to bring home. So he said, well, you'll be in Kaneohe Bay, just relax, swim, go to have fun. The carrier will be in 5 days. You sleep on the deck practically. They had so many people coming back. So I was sitting in a wardroom there, just gossiping. A guy walks in and said, we have a war-weary airplane that we fly back to Hawaii tonight. Anybody want to do it? So I jumped up right away and said, I'd love to. So I ran there, and they verified the fact that I now had my plane commander's first pilot's license and all that. And they said, okay. And a volunteer group also that wanted to get home rather than wait for the carrier and be on the carrier another 5 days to get home, we flew the plane back. So my last flight in the Navy was flying a PBM back, an old war-weary aircraft that they were going to study, with a pickup crew, and going through the whole ritual and flying all night, and suddenly dawn coming up and seeing the Golden Gate Bridge, flying with San Francisco buildings towering off the right wing, and looking at that, and then coming in and making a landing at Alameda. I never realized that would be my last flight. And the last flight was, you know, Peter Bodie Mike request permission to land, and we landed the plane, and the book ends with over and out. From there, the decision is, what do we do after that? I could have gone on to the Navy to Quonset Point, Rhode Island, where the other two pilots of my crew were going to go. It was winter. We didn't have winter clothes. We didn't have winter shoes. We didn't have coats, anything. Elaine said, let's get home, finish at college. And the other was, half my squadron went into the airlines. I could do that, but I think Elaine saw the stewardesses at the airlines at that time, which were all about 19, 20 years old, and no way are you going in the airlines. We took the train back to L.A., and we came home, and then I started my civilian life with the greatest education I could ever get on the GI Bill. And that's just another story, too.
Well, maybe they'll have to read about that in the book, and I hope they will get the book, Peter Bogey Mike. And I've got a couple more questions for you. I do want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us about it. Thank you for writing this book so people understand. And that's a question I have. Why write the book? What was it that spurred you? You said, you know what, I'm going to put this out there so people can know what it was about.
I've always wanted to be a writer, and I was the first editor of the school paper and stuff like that. I wrote several short stories, which George Au, my benefactor, had read, and he loved the stories. Why don't you put them together in a book? So I fortunately had my flight book, and it had every flight that I ever took with whoever the instructor was. So when you read it, not that I remember them now, but it certainly brought me in proper sequence. Like I flew out with Ensign McCaslin, and he gave me an up check or down or whatever, and I just followed all the way through.
And there's some good sense of humor in that book.
sense of humor has always been part of me, sometimes for good and sometimes for bad. You get in trouble too much with it.
Maybe that's the point to segue to what's your secret for almost now a couple months away from 70 years of marriage. A lot of people don't think that's possible anymore. So what's your secret?
As I said before, it's in the genes, I think. And the fact is that we have a great respect. And I think having good kids and having a wonderful family, our family is a mixed family. It's funny, starting out in Boyle Heights in an ethnic group, we have half of our kids are part Chinese, half of them are Filipino, some of them are Hawaiian, and we have Presbyterian, we have Jewish, we have our whole group of family is mixed, intermixed, and the kids love each other. They contact each other, they call each other, and most of them have stayed in our house at one time or another, and we just have this great family feeling, and I think that does a lot to keep a thing cohesive. We're very, very fortunate. The reason we got married, of course, if I wanted to go to bed with my girlfriend, the only way I could do it was get married. So I don't know how it works today, but it worked out well for us.
On that note, we are out of time. That is Irvin Cooper, 92 years old, of Los Angeles, California. Pick up that book, Peter, Bogey, Mike, and make sure you tune in again next time when we remind you once again that freedom is not free. There's a little bit more to our interview I couldn't quite squeeze in. You'll hear that in a moment. And let me give you that address again for the book. Peter Bogey Mike, P.O. Box 34673, Los Angeles, California, 90034. When it comes to World War II, what are you most proud of?
I'm proud of the fact that America reacted the way they did, and the fact that all the military work, all the planes, military uniforms, there was a limitation of 10% that the government allowed all the manufacturers to make, period. There was no supposedly no profit. The thing I resent most, and we have not been in a declared war since that time, I'm most bitter about the fact that people that joined the reserve are ending up in Afghanistan and all over around the world without a declared war for what? It really is upsetting. So part of it is pride, and the part of it is bitterness on this end.